Chapter 80. A family in a very small way, we must suppose little George Osborne has ridden from Knightsbridge towards Fulham, and will stop, and make inquiries at that village regarding some friends whom we have left there. How is Mrs. Amelia after the storm of Waterloo? Is she living and thriving? What has come of Major Dobbin, whose cab was always hankering about her premises? And is there any news of the collector of Boggleywolla? The facts concerning the latter are briefly these. Our worthy fat friend Joseph Sedley returned to India not long after his escape from Brussels. Either his furlough was up, or he dreaded to meet any witnesses of his Waterloo flight. However it might be, he went back to his duties in Bengal very soon after Napoleon had taken up his residence at St. Helena, where Joe saw the ex-emperor. To hear Mr. Sedley talk on board ship, he would have supposed that it was not the first time he and the Corsican had met, and that the civilian had bearded the French general at Mount St. John. He had a thousand anecdotes about the famous battles. He knew the position of every regiment, and the loss which each had incurred. He did not deny that he had been concerned in those victories, that he had been with the army, and carried dispatches for the Duke of Wellington. And he described what the Duke did, and said on every conceivable moment of the day of Waterloo, with such an accurate knowledge of his Grace's sentiments and proceedings, that it was clear he must have been by the conqueror's side throughout the day, though, as a non-combatant, his name was not mentioned in the public documents relative to the battle. Perhaps he actually worked himself up to believe that he had been engaged with the army. Certain it is that he made a prodigious sensation for some time at Calcutta, and was called Waterloo Sedley during the whole of his subsequent stay in Bengal. The bills which Joes had given for the purchase of those unlucky horses were paid without question by him and his agents. He never was heard to allude to the bargain, and nobody knows for a certainty what became of the horses, or how he got rid of them, or of Isidore, his Belgian servant, who sold a grey horse, very like the one which Joes rode, at Valenciennes sometime during the autumn of 1815. Joes' London agents had orders to pay £120 yearly to his parents at Fulham. It was the chief support of the old couple, for Mr. Sedley's speculations in life subsequent to his bankruptcy did not by any means retrieve the broken old gentleman's fortune. He tried to be a wine merchant, a coal merchant, a commission lottery agent, and see. He sent round prospectuses to his friends whenever he took a new trade, and ordered a new brass plate for the door, and talked pompously about making his fortune still. But fortune never came back to the feeble and stricken old man. One by one his friends dropped off, and were weary of buying dear coals and bad wine from him, and there was only his wife in all the world who fancied, when he tottered off to the city of a morning, that he was still doing any business there. At evening he crawled slowly back, and he used to go of nights to a little club at a tavern, where he disposed of the finances of the nation. It was wonderful to hear him talk about millions, and agios, and discounts, and what Rothschild was doing, and Baring Brothers. He talked of such vast sums, that the gentlemen of the club, the apothecary, the undertaker, the great carpenter and builder, the parish clerk, who was allowed to come stealthily, and Mr. Clapp, our old acquaintance, respected the old gentleman. Was better off once, sir, he did not fail to tell everybody who set the room. My son, sir, is at this minute chief magistrate of Ramganj in the presidency of Bengal, and touching his 4,000 rupees per mensum. My daughter might be a colonel's lady if she liked. I might draw upon my son, the first magistrate, sir, for £2,000 tomorrow, and Alexander would cash my bill, down sir, down on the counter, sir. But the Sedleys were always a proud family. You and I, my dear reader, may drop into this condition one day. For have not many of our friends attained it? Our luck may fail. Our powers forsake us. Our place on the boards be taken by better and younger mimes, the chance of life roll away, and leave us shattered and stranded. Then men will walk across the road when they meet you, or, worse still, hold you out a couple of fingers, and patronize you in a pitying way. Then you will know, as soon as your back is turned, that your friend begins with a poor devil, what imprudences he has committed, what chances that chap has thrown away. Well, a carriage and 3,000 a year is not the summit of the reward, nor the end of God's judgment of men. If quacks prosper as often as they go to the wall, if zanies succeed, and knaves arrive at fortune, and, vice versa, sharing ill luck and prosperity for all the world like the ablest and most honest amongst us, I say, brother, the gifts and pleasures of Vanity Fair cannot be held of any great account, and that it is probable. But we are wandering out of the domain of the story. Had Mrs. Sedley been a woman of energy, she would have exerted it after her husband's ruin, and, occupying a large house, would have taken in boarders. The broken Sedley would have acted well as the boarding house landlady's husband, the Muniz of private life, the titular lord and master, the carver, house steward, and humble husband of the occupier of the dingy throne. I have seen men of good brains and breeding, and of good hopes and vigor once, who feasted squires and kept hunters in their youth, meekly cutting up legs of mutton for rancorous old harridans and pretending to preside over their dreary tables. But Mrs. Sedley, we say, had not spirit enough to bustle about for few select inmates to join a cheerful musical family, such as one reads of in the Times. She was content to lie on the shore, where fortune had stranded her, and you could see that the career of this old couple was over. I don't think they were unhappy. Perhaps they were a little prouder in their downfall than in their prosperity. Mrs. Sedley was always a great person for her landlady, Mrs. Clapp, when she descended and passed many hours with her in the basement or ornamented kitchen. The Irish maid Betty Flanagan's bonnets and ribbons, her sauciness, her idleness, her reckless prodigality of kitchen candles, her consumption of tea and sugar, and so forth occupied and amused the old lady almost as much as the doings of her former household, when he had Sambo and the coachman, and a groom, and a footboy, and a housekeeper with a regiment of female domestics her former household, about which the good lady talked 100 times a day. And besides Betty Flanagan, Mrs. Sedley had all the maids of all work in the street to superintend. She knew how each tenant of the cottages paid, or owed his little rent. She stepped aside when Mrs. Rougemont, the actress, passed with her dubious family. She flung up her head when Mrs. Pessler, the apothecary's lady, drove by in her husband's professional one-horse chaise. He had colloquies with the greengrocer about the penn'orth of turnips which Mr. Sedley loved. She kept an eye upon the milkman and the baker's boy, and made visitations to the butcher, who sold hundreds of oxen very likely with less ado than was made about Mrs. Sedley's loin of mutton. And she counted the potatoes under the joint on Sundays, on which days, dressed in her best, she went to church twice, and read Blair's sermons in the evening. On that day, for usiness prevented him on weekdays from taking such a pleasure, it was old Sedley's delight to take out his little grandson Georgie to the neighboring parks or Kensington Gardens, to see the soldiers, or to feed the ducks. Georgie loved the redcoats, and his grandpapa told him how his father had been a famous soldier, and introduced him to many sergeants and others with Waterloo medals on their breasts, to whom the old grandfather pompously presented the child as the son of Captain Osborne of the TH, who died gloriously on the glorious 18th. He has been known to treat some of these non-commissioned gentlemen to a glass of porter, and, indeed, in their first Sunday walks was disposed to spoil little Georgie, sadly gorging the boy with apples and Parliament, to the detriment of his health, until Amelia declared that George should never go out with his grandpapa, unless the latter promised solemnly, and on his honor, not to give the child any cakes, lollipops, or stall produce whatever. Between Mrs. Sedley and her daughter there was a sort of coolness about this boy, and a secret jealousy for one evening in George's very early days, Amelia, who had been seated at work in their little parlor scarcely remarking that the old lady had quitted the room, ran upstairs instinctively to the nursery at the cries of the child, who had been asleep until that moment, and there found Mrs. Sedley in the act of surreptitiously administering Daffy's elixir to the infant. Amelia, the gentlest and sweetest of everyday mortals, when she found this meddling with her maternal authority, thrilled and trembled all over with anger. Her cheeks, ordinarily pale, now flushed up, until they were as red as they used to be when she was a child of 12 years old. She seized the baby out of her mother's arms, and then grasped at the bottle, leaving the old lady gaping at her, furious, and holding the guilty teaspoon. Amelia flung the bottle crashing into the fireplace. I will not have baby poisoned, Mama, cried Emmy, rocking the infant about violently with both her arms round him, and turning with flashing eyes at her mother. Poisoned, Amelia, said the old lady, this language to me? He shall not have any medicine but that which Mr. Pessler sends for H.I.N. He told me that Daffy's elixir was poison. Very good. You think I may murder us then, replied Mrs. Sedley. This is the language you use to your mother. I have met with misfortunes. I have sunk low in life. I have kept my carriage, and now walk on foot. But I did not know I was a murderess before, and thank you for the news. Mama, said the poor girl, who was always ready for tears, who shouldn't be hard upon me. I did not wish to say you would do any wrong to this dear child, only, oh, no, my love, only that I was a murderess, in which case I had better go to the Old Bailey. Though I didn't poison you when you were a child, but gave you the best of education and the most expensive master's money could procure. Yes, I've nursed 5 children and buried 3. And the one I loved the best of all, and tended through croup, and teething, and measles, and whooping cough, and brought up with foreign masters, regardless of expense, and with accomplishments at Minerva House which I never had, when I was a girl, when I was too glad to honor my father and mother, that I might live long in the land, and to be useful, and not to mope all day in my room, and act the fine lady says I'm a murderess. Ah, Mrs. Osborne, may you never nourish a viper in your bosom, that's my prayer. Mama, Mama, cried the bewildered girl, and the child in her arms set up a frantic chorus of shouts. A murderess, indeed. Go down on your knees, and pray to God, to cleanse your wicked ungrateful heart, Amelia, and may he forgive you as I do. And Mrs. Sedley tossed out of the room, hissing out the word poison once more, and so ending her charitable benediction. Till the termination of her natural life, this breach between Mrs. Sedley and her daughter was never thoroughly mended. The quarrel gave the elder lady numberless advantages which she did not fail to turn to account with female ingenuity and perseverance. For instance, she scarcely spoke to Amelia for many weeks afterwards. She warned the domestics not to touch the child, as Mrs. Osborne might be offended. She asked her daughter to see and satisfy herself that there was no poison prepared in the little daily messes that were concocted for Georgie. When neighbors asked after the boy's health, she referred them pointedly to Mrs. Osborne. She never ventured to ask whether the baby was well or not. She would not touch the child, although he was her grandson, and own precious darling, for she was not used to children, and might kill it. And whenever Mr. Pessler came upon his healing inquisition, she received the doctor with such a sarcastic and scornful demeanor, as made the surgeon declare that not Lady Thistlewood herself, whom he had the honor of attending professionally, could give herself greater airs than old Mrs. Sedley, from whom he never took a fee. And very likely Emmy was jealous too, upon her own part, as what mother is not, of those who would manage her children for her, or become candidates for the first place in their affections. It is certain that when anybody nursed the child, she was uneasy, and that she would no more allow Mrs. Clapp, or the domestic to dress or tend him than she would have let them wash her husband's miniature which hung up over her little bed, the same little bed from which the poor girl had gone to his, and to which she retired now for many long, silent, tearful, but happy years. In this room was all Amelia's heart and treasure. Here it was that she tended her boy, and watched him through the many ills of childhood, with a constant passion of love. The elder George returned in him somehow, only improved, and as if come back from heaven. In a hundred little tones, looks, and movements, the child was so like his father, that the widow's heart thrilled as she held him to it, and he would often ask the cause of her tears. It was because of his likeness to his father, she did not scruple to tell him. She talked constantly to him about this dead father, and spoke of her love for George to the innocent and wondering child, much more than she ever had done to George himself, or to any confidant of her youth. To her parents she never talked about this matter, shrinking from baring her heart to them. Little George very likely could understand no better than they, but into his ears she poured her sentimental secrets unreservedly, and into his only. The very joy of this woman was a sort of grief, or so tender, at least, that its expression was tears. Her sensibilities were so weak and tremulous that perhaps they ought not to be talked about in a book. I was told by Dr. Pessler, now a most flourishing ladies' physician, with a sumptuous dark green carriage, a prospect of speedy knighthood, and a house in Manchester Square, that her grief at weaning the child was a sight that would have unmanned a Herod. He was very soft-hearted many years ago, and his wife was mortally jealous of Mrs. Amelia, then and long afterwards. Perhaps the doctor's lady had good reason for her jealousy. Most women shared it, of those who formed the small circle of Amelia's acquaintance, and were quite angry at the enthusiasm with which the other sex regarded her. For almost all men who came near her loved her, though no doubt they would be at a loss to tell you why. She was not brilliant, nor witty, nor wise overmuch, nor extraordinarily handsome. But wherever she went she touched and charmed every one of the male sex, as invariably as she awakened the scorn and incredulity of her own sisterhood. I think it was her weakness which was her principal charm, a kind of sweet submission and softness, which seemed to appeal to each man she met for his sympathy and protection. We have seen how in the regiment, though she spoke but to few of George's comrades there, all the swords of the young fellows at the mess table would have leapt from their scabbards to fight round her, and so it was in the little narrow lodging house and circle at Fulham, she interested and pleased everybody. If she had been Mrs. Mango herself, of the great house of Mango, Planton, and Company, Crutched Friars, and the magnificent proprietress of the Pineries, Fulham, who gave summer dejeuners frequented by dukes and earls, and drove about the parish with magnificent yellow liveries and bay horses, such as the royal stables at Kensington themselves could not turn out, I say, had she been Mrs. Mango herself, or her son's wife, Lady Mary Mango, daughter of the Earl of Castlemouldy, who condescended to marry the head of the firm, the tradesman of the neighborhood, could not pay her more honor than they invariably showed. To the gentle young widow, when she passed by their doors, or made her humble purchases at their shops. Thus it was not only Mr. Pessler, the medical man, but Mr. Linton the young assistant, who doctored the servant maids and small tradesmen, and might be seen any day reading the Times in the surgery, who openly declared himself the slave of Mrs. Osborne. He was a personable young gentleman, more welcome at Mrs. Sedley's lodgings than his principal, and if anything went wrong with Georgie, he would drop in twice or thrice in the day, to see the little chap, and without so much as the thought of a fee. He would abstract lozenges, tamarinds, and other produce from the surgery drawers for little Georgie's benefit, and compounded draughts and mixtures for him of miraculous sweetness, so that it was quite a pleasure to the child to be ailing. He and Pessler, his chief, sat up two whole nights by the boy in that momentous and awful week, when Georgie had the measles, and when you would have thought, from the mother's terror, that there had never been measles in the world before. Would they have done as much for other people? Did they sit up for the folks at the Pineries, when Ralph Plantagenet, and Gwendoline, and Guinevere Mango had the same juvenile complaint? Did they sit up for Gutenberg edition? End of chapter.